Hi, this is Joey Burns of Calexico, and I'm here today on KCRW talking about pie. And I'm not talking about the number, I'm talking about the food. I do love pie, I love food in general, and my earliest memories of pie would be from growing up at home here in the South Bay. And my mom, every now and then, would get her grandmother's apple pie recipe. And of course, she's from Rochester, New York, so they do a little slice of cheddar cheese on top of the pie. I just remember walking home and into the kitchen and being just consumed by the smell. And I think that's one of the things about pie is that you're first hit by the olfactory, by the smell, and especially a kitchen. So that was my first entry into the love of pie. In Arizona, because of the pecan trees around there, there is an abundance of pecan pie, which I was late to the party as far as loving pecan pie. But over time, and thanks to the Hotel Congress, which is downtown Tucson, there's a beautiful cafe there called the Cup Cafe, and they make some incredible desserts, especially a wicked pecan pie. And you have to have it with a scoop of vanilla ice cream. It's super important.
Yes, it is back. Are you ready to talk about pie? From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. If you've been listening to this show for years, you know this. I love pie. And believe it or not, there was a time when I was terrible at making it. So in the summer of 2009, I pledged to myself to make a pie a day. Seriously, I made a pie every single day for the whole summer. From there, the Good Food Pie Contest was born, and now it's back for the seventh year in a row. Registration is officially open for the seventh annual Good Food Pie Contest at the Fowler Museum at UCLA. The contest is October 4th, so enter now and you will have months to practice. And trust me, practice makes perfect. Should have seen my first pies back in 2009. So sad. Just go to kcrw.com/pie for all the details. And meanwhile, my next guest is here for a little inspiration. Marina Bood is the author of the popular blog Rosewater and Orange Blossoms, where I first spotted her recipe for sour cherry pie. So Maureen, about those sour cherries that you are so lucky because you have in such abundance in Michigan. Talk to us about the perfect sour cherry pie.
The perfect sour cherry pie really lets the cherry flavor shine through. And I think that that happens when perhaps a little bit of citrus peel is included, like a grated lime zest or lemon. And I always like to include a touch of rose water, a few drops of rose water, which bring up the flavors of a fruit like a sour cherry. And you don't necessarily taste something floral, but you taste more cherry. And then you're going to fill your also perfect pie crust. I love my mother's crust, which we make with oil rather than butter. And it always comes out delicious, and it's a little bit salted, and it just has a wonderful balance with the very sweet sour cherry pie filling.
Okay, so I have to ask you about this oil pie crust because it's so unusual. It seems like it must be much easier than futzing with keeping butter cold, etc.
I find it to be much, much easier. The difference would be that you're rolling out the crust between layers of wax paper as opposed to right on your countertop. But you just peel the paper off and you can flip the crust over into your pie tin and ease it down in, and it shapes beautifully. The crimping shapes just beautifully around the edges, and it gets a very wonderful golden brown on top. I like to rub the top with a little bit of milk, and then always a spoonful, a couple spoonsful of sugar on top when it comes out of the oven. And it never fails to be super flaky.
What kind of oil do you use?
I use canola. My mother uses vegetable safflower oil, is also wonderful here, a neutral oil. And you stir it up and you kind of get that same sort of small pea-like consistency as you're stirring the dough with a spoon. And you don't have to worry about the temperature, which is great. And you don't have to put it in the refrigerator to chill. It just goes right from the bowl to rolling it out. In fact, you want to work quickly there. But it rolls out beautifully. And the crust just, everyone always wants to know what this recipe is when they taste it, because it's just very flaky. I've never made an oil-based crust that came out tough like a butter crust can sometimes do.
Well, Maureen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Maureen Abood is the author of the popular blog Rosewater and Orange Blossoms, and she has a wonderful cookbook out of the same name. We've got a link to her mom's vegan oil-based pie dough on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. You want to know what goes well with pie? Fried chicken. Are there any two foods more suited for a summer picnic? And there's so much more to know about making good fried chicken than just that tried and true Crisco in a cast iron pan. Rebecca Lang gives us an education in her new book, Fried Chicken. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good.
So let's start with the chicken. There are so many options these days. We can get pasture-raised, we can get air-chilled chickens, and we can get chickens of many different sizes. What should we be looking for?
Well, I think in general, as far as size, you want to focus on the smaller the chicken, the better. The larger that the bird gets, you actually end up with, you can have tougher meat. So I really think the perfect bird is probably 3.5 pounds. And I like to buy a whole bird and I like to cut it up myself, because if you go to the grocery store and you buy one bird already cut up, usually those pieces are not necessarily from the same bird and they can be a lot larger than what you would get if you just bought a 3.5 pound little chicken.
Once we've decided on the kind of chicken that we're going to get and we've found a little guy, talk to me about the differences between skillet frying and deep frying. I have to say that I tend to prefer things that are fried in a skillet.
It tends to be a very southern thing to fry in a skillet. Cast iron skillets in the South are everywhere. I probably own, gosh, maybe 18 myself. And that's unusual. Not everybody has a stack of skillets. But by the end of the book, I fried more chicken than most people will eat in a lifetime over 9 months to test every recipe and work on the book. And I've changed over to being a deep frying girl, because skillet frying, I think, especially for people who are new to frying, skillet frying takes a little bit more skill in the fact that you have to watch when to turn the chicken over. You've got to make sure that the oil is, or the grease, whatever you may be frying in, is just the right temperature. You have to be more careful with that, I think, in skillet frying than you do in deep. And I tell you, if you just want to be almost mindlessly frying, to have an electric deep fryer that you set the temperature to, it beeps when it's ready, and you put your chicken in, it does not get any easier than that.
So when we're deep frying, I think the thing that scares most people, the idea of deep frying, is just dealing with a ton of oil. First of all, what is your preferred oil when you're deep frying? And how much do those little machines use? And can you store them in there?
For your first question, my preferred oil when I'm deep frying, almost always I use canola, because canola can get up to a nice high temperature. But that being said, in this book, I have fried in anything that will fry. But I think canola or vegetable for fried deep frying is really the easiest. I've used peanut. That has a super high smoke point. That's nice, too. Sometimes a little bit harder to find. And it depends on the fryer as far as, it depends what size it is as to how much oil it will hold. I tested recipes with actually a deep fryer that was the size that would fit a turkey. So you can imagine how large it was. Mine held 2 gallons, but you also have the standard size that probably holds 1/2 gallon. So the thing is with those two that does make it a little bit easier is the oil is contained. Nothing needs to be moved over like a pot on a stove would be moved over. And you turn the fryer off, you put the lid on it, the oil cools to room temperature, put it in a container. You can even put it in a zip-top plastic bag and then just put it in the trash if you don't have a place you can recycle the oil. But never, never pour it down the drain. That's the worst thing on your plumbing system you can do.
So, Rebecca, let's get right down to it. This phrase, Southern fried chicken, when people say that, do they mean a particular template or does it just vary from house to house?
There's less variation than you seem to think because it all kind of stems from the same place. Like most people, almost everybody would either soak their chicken in buttermilk, which is kind of the most traditional way, or they would soak their chicken in essentially a brine, and it wasn't called a brine back when everybody started doing that. My grandmother's chicken, she soaked in salt water, which is a brine. And so you have those two realms that you're either a salt water or you're a buttermilk fryer, but those are pretty much what Southern fried chicken is. Everybody used a whole bird, everybody cut up the bird, and usually just used a simple white flour, salt and pepper on the outside. And most people either fry in lard or in hydrogenated vegetable oil.
Rebecca, there's also a big link between a biscuit and fried chicken. I mean, we all know about Chick-fil-A. Is there a way we can make those at home?
Oh, sure. I have a really good recipe, actually, that I do a honey chicken with a honey sauce with biscuits. Because a biscuit, you're right, a biscuit and a chicken just go together perfectly. The biscuits, which if you haven't made biscuits before, to make buttermilk biscuits will just kind of change your life. And once you've done it once, it'll be great. You want to use whole buttermilk, which is, if you have local dairy farms around, it's real easy to find whole buttermilk, but a lot of times mainstream buttermilk has been lightened, and I find that whole buttermilk makes better biscuits. The one reason the Southerners, we all make really good biscuits, is we have really good flour. So you want to try to use Southern self-rising flour. And I know a lot of brands are sold all around the country. You can order them online, too, like White Lily and Martha White. But the wheat is actually harvested in the winter, so you have a softer wheat to make a softer biscuit. And I have a recipe in the book, if you live somewhere you can't buy Southern flour, how you can actually make this Southern self-rising flour yourself, which is just a mixture of cake flour, all-purpose flour, and some leavening. So it's pretty easy to do if you don't have it. Then you can just kind of keep your container at home and be ready to go with it. But you're right, biscuits and chicken are just two peas in a pod.
And what is the deal with honey and chicken?
I think a lot of people use honey and chicken because they like to have something sweet on top of something so salty. Plus, a lot of times in the South and years ago, that was the sweetener of choice. That's what people had on hand. So if you wanted to add a little something to your chicken, sure was easy to grab the honey and pour some on.
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Oh, thank you. This has been fun.
That was Rebecca Lang. Her book is Fried Chicken: Recipes for the Crispy, Crunchy Comfort Food Classic. Check out the Good Food blog for her recipe for honeyed fried chicken with hot honey sauce and biscuits. I dare you not to have to go make that. Coming up, save your appetite. Firefly squid with fermented bonito guts is on the menu next when Jonathan Gold stops by for a visit. Stay with us.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Good Food. Jonathan Gold is in the studio with me. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And today, we're off to Kinjiro, a new izakaya in Little Tokyo. But first, what does that even mean, izakaya?
Izakaya is, I guess to put it in simplest terms, it's a place where you go to drink and then eat some food.
So it's a gastropub.
It's basically a gastropub. And izakaya menu can be really intimidating for people who haven't been there before because there'll be a lot of unfamiliar preparations and the menu items will be in different categories. And all you have to remember is you're going to drink and you're going to eat some stuff.
Yeah, and order from column A and column B and column C.
Exactly.
Okay, so what did you particularly like here?
Because it's an izakaya, I think maybe we should start with the drinks, because when you're there, that's what you're going to start with. They have a really large selection of beers from Hitachino Nest.
Ooh, love that.
We all know the red rice ale with the picture of the friendly owl on it, but they've got, you know, almost a dozen different beers from them, which are all good. And for some reason, the drink that I've been most captivated by is a sake called Cowboy.
Cowboy?
Yeah.
What kind of sake is it?
All the reviews I've read and all the people I've talked to about it, it's almost designed as a red meat sake. It's robust and it has saline flavors almost. It's almost salty. It's not quite salty. And it goes very well with meat and with strong, hearty flavors. It's delicious stuff.
So take us to the food. Are we ready to talk about the food?
Yeah. Some of the most interesting food here is they call it sake no sakana. It's a selection of tiny dishes that are meant specifically to be enjoyed with sake. And they tend to be very funky and very fermented and strong, but also light and delicious. So there's a firefly squid that's been sort of cut into ribbons and marinated with soy sauce that's a lighter version, or there's another kind of squid that's cut into broader ribbons and marinated with squid ink.
Really?
But allowed to ferment, so it's strong. You get the squid ink flavor that you recognize, but it has a depth to it that you don't find in, say, Italian pasta.
And how are those squid preparations cooked?
I'm not sure they're cooked. They're raw.
They're raw.
They're just marinated and they're served in little bowls. You can get three of them for $10, which is a good way to go. And probably the strongest and the most traditional is the fermented bonito guts, which is the inside of a fish. It's very strong, really super funky, and it's served in what is apparently the way that they're often served these days, on a slab of cream cheese.
There are so many parts to that sentence I was not prepared for.
So think of it as like, you know, it's salty and it's strong and it's, yeah, maybe the Japanese equivalent of like lox and cream cheese.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
You're probably going to want some of the raw cold dishes, like small cups containing, you know, uni and sliced scallop and blue crab meat in sort of a jellied ponzu sauce.
That sounds marvelous.
So delicate. And the nuttiness of the uni is really accentuated and the sweetness of the crab. It all comes out. It's not all super weird stuff. Like they do a ceviche that will be familiar to anybody who's had sort of the Matsuhisa style ceviche. They do carpaccio of, you know, wagyu beef. I think it's a chuck cut, but it's really nicely marbled and it's topped with a little bit of like vinegar sauce flavored with Sancho pepper, which is very close to Sichuan peppercorn. So it's like a numbing sensation. There's mackerel, which is somewhat like the saba you get in a sushi bar, marinated in that manner, with little dots of yuzu koshu, which is one of my favorite condiments ever, made with hot chilies and yuzu zest.
Wow. This sounds fantastic. Now, when I think of izakaya food, I also think of a lot of grilled things, like things on skewers.
They do a certain amount of that. Not as much as some other places, but we talked about it being sort of meaty. So there'll be a dengaku, which is sort of it's like something grilled and coated with like a thick sweet sauce of bone marrow, which is really untraditional. I mean, both times I've had it, the waiter has pointed out that bone marrow is technically illegal in Japan right now.
Oh, really?
I think it has something to do with mad cow, but he wasn't sure, and I haven't been able to find anything out about it. But he said that, like, you know, Japanese tourists, when they come in, go immediately for that because they haven't been able to get it in several years. One of their specialties is probably grilled beef tongue cut into thick slabs and served super simply with sea salt. And as is usual, at the end of a meal like this, you're probably going to want ochazuke in some form or another. Ochazuke being, you know, basically rice with hot tea poured over it. As they say when they serve it, well, you're supposed to use tea, but we use dashi because we're fancy. Somehow, you know, the hot broth poured from a ceramic vessel onto the rice with, like, little bits of pickled plum and shiso. It's so refreshing. It's so the way you want to go out.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Kinjiro in Little Tokyo. Text the words good food to 69866, and you will get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Or you can just go ahead and find it on the Good Food Restaurant map, which lives on the Good Food blog. Banh mi. It's sweet, sour, crunchy, spicy, and silky. It's the near-perfect sandwich. And when I have a craving, I know just where to find it. Orange County. Orange County is home to the largest Vietnamese population outside of Vietnam. And of course, there's no shortage of sandwich shops peddling those baguettes filled with pâté and pickled vegetables. But Linda Sandwich in Westminster has a rather peculiar claim to fame. Lisa Morehouse has the story.
Linda Trung Dai is the most glamorous proprietor of a sandwich shop I've ever seen. She sports stiletto heels, a short skirt, and perfect makeup, including false eyelashes. And she's a bit of a diva. She makes me wait 2 hours to interview her. Yet in between text messages and phone calls, she's the one running to the kitchen, checking an industrial mixer as it churns a special sauce for the sandwiches.
This is my sauce maker.
She's the only one who knows the recipe.
When I do something, I'm really, really into it. So I have to do it on my own because I created that. And if I do it, it would be 100%.
Her shop is called Linda Sandwich. It's in a nondescript building in the middle of a parking lot in a strip mall. But inside, it feels like a posh living room. Lush plants, murals of her idols like Michael Jackson and Marilyn Monroe are painted in bold colors. A widescreen TV is playing the Food Network. There's also a wall of fame with framed images of Vietnamese American singers. But Linda Trung Dai, the store's owner, might be more famous than any of them. Patrick Pham is a customer here.
I used to like watch her in videos with my parents when I was a kid growing up. So she's pretty famous among the Vietnamese community. I never met her personally.
I point out she's actually at a table just a few feet away.
I know. They have really, really good food here. Really simple. I think like the whole baguette came from like France, you know, when they colonized this for 100 years.
Javier Acala works at the local community college and comes about 2 times a week for an unconventional banh mi.
I'm having the banh mi cha tom, which is the shrimp cake banh mi sandwich, which is my favorite. And the little egg rolls to go with it just for a little extra crunch.
Acala first came in out of curiosity. For years, he'd seen posters around town announcing the singer's concerts.
The Madonna of Little Saigon.
Linda's life story is pretty extraordinary, but get her talking and it sounds more like a food log. She grew up in the early 70s in central Vietnam.
I remember sitting on this wooden table. My grandmother taught me how to make these banh bao. It's called banh bao, which is dough with shrimp on it.
A dish she still loves. After the war, her family went from well off to poor.
I would buy fruit, like I would buy the whole big watermelon, cut it up and sell it and make money.
And then in 1979, her father got tipped off that the government was going to investigate him on suspicion of aiding the CIA during the war.
So we escape on a boat.
At 2 a.m, the family split between tiny boats.
It was so scary. We had to be quiet. We were like so like quiet and just, it was scary. Because if we get caught, we go to jail.
They went through storms and ran out of food.
And then finally we went to one of the China Island and they kind of rescue us with rice and sugar. You know, it's strange to eat rice with sugar, but, you know, it was so good at the time.
They got back on the water, headed for Hong Kong, and then saw the large British ship that would save them.
We were, like, waving, and, oh, my God, I could never forget. It was just unbelievable, amazing, most amazing moment. And when we got up to, they rescue us into the land, and they give us croissant.
Eating that croissant was like going from hell to heaven, she says. But when her family got to the U.S., she developed another passion. And found her first career. In this video, she's wearing a sparkly bustier. She's surrounded by dancers holding mirrors. Tons of people saw this. In the 90s, in any home throughout the Vietnamese diaspora, you'd probably find a VHS tape featuring Linda Trung Dai. And here's how that happened. She always loved to sing, the first to volunteer in elementary school, she says. As a high school student, she started performing in tiny venues around Little Saigon, putting up her own flyers. And then one night, she was discovered singing at a club. She was invited to film her first spot in the variety show called Paris by Night, a hugely popular video series. So she missed her high school graduation and flew to France. That series was meant for the diaspora.
Back then, the people in Vietnam, they have to hide it. It's illegal to watch it. And if they get caught, they will be fined or go to jail.
But an estimated 72 million people in Vietnam also watched. Linda started touring Vietnamese communities around the U.S. and the world. And she still tours sometimes. Tonight, though, she's here in Westminster at a banquet hall, just a few hundred feet away from her banh mi shop. The crowd is dressed to the nines.
My name is Hong Nguyen.
And I'm Juliet Nguyen. We're sisters and we grew up in Alabama.
Down south. These were the big Vietnamese stars when we were younger and we used to watch them on videos and we'd go to their concerts whenever they did come down south.
The sisters say there weren't a lot of Vietnamese people in Alabama in the 80s.
There was only like 3 Asian in my school and that was 2 of them were my sisters. So.
Their parents wanted them to see older performers singing traditional songs in Vietnamese. But it was acts like Linda, singing in English, that drew the sisters in. Tonight, the singer is dressed in a barely there, strappy outfit. It fits the image the sisters remember.
Yeah. She was considered the sex symbol of her time, right, for a yeah. Vietnamese singer?
She was the Madonna, the Vietnamese Madonna. Yeah. Her.
That comparison thrills Linda.
I kind of got influenced by Madonna.
Her dance music, her choreography.
And I think another thing was I had the guts, you know, to get up there and just be brave.
And wear outfits really different from those other variety show performers.
Very sexy, revealing, very. And of course, when I first started, Vietnamese older people were kind of against it because they're not used to it.
She says she worked hard to communicate that that was just her onstage persona.
And when I'm offstage, I'm like 100% completely different. A total Vietnamese traditional girl who takes care of their family, food on the table, everything.
Case in point, she started her sandwich shop as a business with her family. Before that, even when she was on tour, she was obsessed with Vietnamese food. She says the first time she went to Australia,
I just brought so many different kind of Vietnamese food from here on the plane. Bánh bèo, and I even brought this soup noodle, bún bò Huế.
She asked the flight attendant to heat it up for her.
And all the other Vietnamese singer would look at me, you are so weird.
But on tour, she found good Vietnamese food all over the world and started a kind of ritual.
Any city I would go to, I would check in at the hotel, throw my luggage, and go find Vietnamese restaurants.
She made restaurant recommendations and meals for her fellow singers.
And they always say, oh my God, if you had a restaurant, we would all support you and all that. And I was like, okay, yeah, right, whatever.
But the idea stuck. And Linda Sandwich was born.
Thank you.
A small staff does most of the food prep and sales, but Linda Trang Dai is still the only one to make the special Linda sauce.
Sometimes when I travel to Australia to sing on a tour or to Europe, I would be up all night here making sauce and sleep on the plane.
Anything, she says, for a great meal. For good food, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
That story was made possible by KCRW's Independent Producer Project. Think you've got what it takes to make a great radio story? Enter KCRW's 24-hour radio race. On August 8th, participants will race to write, record, and edit a nonfiction radio story in just 24 hours. It's a lot of fun. Check out details on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. The Dalai Lama of stone fruit, the Giro of apricots, the last farmer standing in Silicon Valley. Don't fall off the edge of your seat. I'll introduce him to you next when Good Food continues.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. There was a very special visitor at the Santa Monica Farmers Market on Wednesday. Laura Avery was there with him, and she's here now with her weekly report.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We are so excited today at the Wednesday Market to have Andy Mariani, who is the owner, founding father of Andy's Orchard, the orchard that comes down here seasonally, whom David Karp is associated with as a grower. And Andy Mariani, you are here at the market. You told me last time you were here was right when they opened the Santa Monica Freeway, practically. Now, you've been farming up in Morgan Hill, which is at the very bottom of Silicon Valley, which was known for many, many years as the Valley of the Heart's Delight. Can you tell us about that growing region and how your farm started?
Yeah, that was one of the greatest fruit-growing regions in the world at one time. Fertile soil, excellent climate, and it's coastal. We have cooler nights and nice warm days, unlike, say, the Central Valley. I equate the kind of climate we have there with the wine regions in the coastal valleys, where from Santa Barbara, Sonoma, Napa, they have premium wines with complex flavors. And so our fruit reflects that same kind of complexity.
So they require not only cool nights, but cold winters. And I guess this whole valley, which is now basically Silicon Valley, was where most of the apricots, including the beloved Blenheim Royal, was grown. What about your neighbors? Who do you know that left and you're still there?
Well, there's very few of us left. There's only a handful of apricot orchards left in what's now Silicon Valley. You know, it's all developed. And it's harder to grow apricots in an area like that because of the development, there's milder winters. And when it's a warmer winter, you just don't get the crops that you normally used to get. So it's a specialty item, and we're sticking it out.
How many years have you been farming there?
We've been there since 1958. And before that, we were in Cupertino. And our old farmstead would be now across the street from the headquarters of Apple Computer on De Anza Boulevard. So we had to move south because that was all developed. And now we're in Morgan Hill, and we've been there, again, over 50 years. Yeah.
And how did you decide what to plant? Your varieties are all so flavorful and unique.
That's an interesting question. I have a passion for really good flavor, and we begged, borrowed, and stole different varieties. Usually we concentrate on heirlooms simply because there was seemed to be more flavor in heirlooms than there are in modern varieties. Modern varieties have been developed for shelf life and great appearance, size, firmness, so that they can withstand the rigors of mass transit and that sort of thing. But we always selected the fruit based on flavor.
Now, we're still waiting for those green gauge plums.
Yeah, you know, we have a problem with the green gauges because it doesn't look like we have much of a crop this year. But whatever we got, we'll certainly share it and bring some down to Santa Monica Farmers Market.
Okay. And now let's a little bit briefly the sour cherries. And you have a small orchard with David Karp, which you've kind of branched off into. Tell us about your cherries.
Well, you know, we've always grown sweet cherries. Sweet cherries is one of the major crops in the Santa Clara Valley. David's brilliant idea was, well, let's plant some sour cherries because there's a demand for it. There's a lot of people that want that. Again, it's flavor. And we planted it last year. So we had a handful of cherries this year, and hopefully next year we'll have more.
Andy. Well, I can't even tell you how much it means to us to have you here, have your fruit here the last couple of years, you yourself coming to visit us, and please keep growing. That was Andy Mariani, way too modest about his amazing farm. He's the owner and founder of Andy's Orchard, and he's down at the Wednesday Market seasonally. He's in right now. Come on down and see what he's got. I'm standing here chatting with Nicole Rucker, who is the co-owner and chef at Kofax and also does pastries at Bledsoe's Barbecue. And Nicole famously was a former KCRW pie contest winner. Nicole, you have a cart with beautiful, large Tenorelli peaches on it. Can you tell us what you're going to be cooking with these peaches?
Yeah, so the Tenorelli peaches I have are the July Flame. I believe this is the last week for them, and then they transition into something else, another yellow peach. This is my favorite peach of all time, so I buy as many of them as my budget will allow. I'm making a chia jam out of them, which is like a low-sugar jam that's set with chia seeds, and we use that in yogurt and granola. We usually eat like a third of them in the kitchen. It's our prize. But after that, we make pies and sell them to Bledsoe's, and then we serve them at Dinosaur Coffee in Silver Lake on Sundays and just use them wherever we can.
So you're a yellow peach fan, but this particular variety, the July Flame, you think is the best, bar none?
Yes. I don't enjoy baking with white peaches. I also don't normally enjoy baking with peaches in general because I think that a lot of peaches have too little acid and you have to peel them, which is kind of a pain in the butt. But the July Flame peaches, when you peel them, they have a really beautiful red color on the inside, so you don't lose that skin contact color that you would get with baking a nectarine, which is my favorite baking stone fruit. Nectarines are great because you can bake them with the skin on and it's less maintenance and less work. But the July Flame is like the only one I'll break for.
I'm conflicted, like you, because I want to buy too much fruit. And then I get it all home. And then the next thing I know, it's getting too ripe. I don't need to make any more jam. How am I going to preserve? Is there a way to just freeze it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in the restaurant, we have a large freezer. And we would cut everything up and put it on a sheet tray so that none of the fruit is piled on top of each other. Kind of like individually place it. Berries are really easy to do that with. Peaches, if you cut them up into slices or, you know, 1-inch chunks, if that's what your thing is, then you can just lay them out on a tray and put them in the freezer. If you don't have a super large freezer that would hold a sheet tray, that could take like days to get through enough fruit, right? So I did a little research when I knew I was going to be talking to you, and I read that Alton Brown likes to get dry ice and break it up and toss his fruit with the dry ice. Everyone has coolers right now because of the 4th of July. So maybe what you do is you put a layer of dry ice in the bottom of the cooler, and then you put a towel over it, and you put a couple sheet trays or something on top of it, and then you put the fruit on top, close the lid, wait a little while, open it up, frozen fruit, and then you can bag it. It depends on the placement of the dry ice, keeps things cold if you put it on the top. If you want to freeze it, you put it underneath it. So it'll freeze solid very quickly.
Okay, now once it's frozen, so you put nothing on the peach. You don't have to, like, you know, put it in a maceration. You just cut a peach in half, freeze it. When it turns into a solid block, throw it in a Ziploc, and then freeze it.
I would slice it first, but you could freeze it in halves. That's kind of a cool idea. I don't think you have to put anything on it. I wouldn't. You know, you will get oxidization when they thaw out, but then when you bake it, you're not going to use a frozen peach like you would in a salad. It's never going to come back that way. But if you're going to make like barbecue sauce out of it later on, or you're going to put it in a pie, then you're going to bake it anyways, and the color doesn't really matter. Because it's going to, you know, the edges that get a little bit browned get kind of like drowned out by the stuff that's on the inside anyways.
Well, these look great, and we have a long summer ahead of us, tons and tons of fruit, so many things to do, and now that we know we can save it in the freezer, I can buy at will.
Yeah, go for it. Buy everything.
Right. All right, Nicole, well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Nicole Rucker, and she's a co-owner and chef at Kofax, and she also makes pastries for Bledsoe's Barbecue, and she's here today with her favorite peaches, the July Flame. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Want to make a peach or a nectarine pie for the pie contest? Well, now you know how to freeze all that fruit. Don't procrastinate. The summer is just flying by. Here's another way to preserve summer fruit: pickling. We usually don't think of pickling fruit, but in Japan, the umeboshi, or pickled plum, is a pantry staple. Food writer and cooking instructor Sonoka Sakai tells me that umeboshi's her favorite subject. Why is it your favorite subject?
It's my culture. It's my grandmother. It's what I ate almost every day growing up. It's medicine, and it's a snack, and it's also a dessert.
What does the word itself mean?
It means dried plums.
Boshi means dried.
Yes.
And ume, is it a kind of plum?
Yes, ume, there's a flowering plum, and there's the ume that we use to make umeboshi, or salted plum. It's not the same plum that we see in the farmer's market right now, that red, sweet, juicy plum. It's a sour plum.
What does it look like when it's on the tree?
Well, it starts out green, and then it starts to go yellow. So when it's fully ripe, it's yellow.
Do people only use the ume for pickling, or do people enjoy them just as a fruit?
It's only for pickling.
Wow.
You cannot eat it. It tastes horrible as a fruit. It doesn't ripen to, you know, an edible sweetness. Yeah.
Does anybody grow ume here in California?
I think it's a hybrid. It doesn't look like the ume that I'm familiar with in Japan. It's smaller, and it's very green. Even in its ripe stage, it blushes a little bit, but it's green.
So describe the finished flavor of umeboshi.
It's salty, sour, and it's fruity.
It's sort of all the things that children love to eat, in a way. Children love, like, that puckery, sour.
Yeah. It makes, you know, you wrinkle a little bit. You know, it's like we say it makes you look like your grandma, because you but now I'm a grandma, so I don't even need to be more wrinkly, but yeah, you pucker, yeah.
And how are they used when they're done?
Well, we eat it with steamed rice, you know, tiny bits of it, or you could just, like, have it with tea. My grandmother used to eat the umeboshi at the end of a meal with rice, and she'll pour the green tea over the leftover rice, you know, into the bowl, and then drop a umeboshi in there and sort of mix it up with her chopsticks and eat it.
It's kind of like a palate cleanser.
Yes, it's a palate cleanser. It aids in digestion. It has other wonderful remedies. I mean, I could give you a whole list of things like hangover and nausea and diarrhea. And
and are they usually eaten whole, dried, or are they wet from the pickling?
Well, they come in a variety. I mean, you could get it whole, crunchy. If it's pickled at a very unripe stage, they come out crunchy. If you let it ripe, not overripe, but you let the fruit ripe, then it tends to be softer. You could also get it in paste form. You could get it very dried. And I think they also sell them as pills, but I've never used those myself. I just, you know, eat the natural ones.
I know that you've been working on a book about onigiri, the little rice balls. They're used in onigiri, aren't they?
Oh, yes. It's probably the most popular onigiri in Japan. It's rice. It basically sits in the middle of your onigiri. So because it's salty, it's like an antibacterial. It plays that kind of role because it preserves the rice, actually.
And when you stick an umeboshi into the onigiri, are they pitted, or do people like the pit still in there?
Well, if you're serving it to children, it's usually pitted. But if you serve it in a bento box, it's with the pit, and it's right in the center of your rice. And if it's a square bento box, it looks like the Japanese flag. So we used to call it, in the old days, like my grandmother would call it the patriotic bento box.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
The sun, right? Sun, yeah. Equals umeboshi.
Yeah. In our culinary community, you're known as a soba master.
Soba maker.
Yeah, I knew you were going to correct me. A soba maker. Do you use umeboshi at all in your soba?
Oh, yes, I do.
How?
As a topping. You just chop it up and put it on top. That's all you need, actually, with a little sauce. That makes a perfect summer dish, I think, with some chopped onions.
Japan has this really intense regional pride about many of its foods. Are ume attached to a certain region, or are they all over?
There are some regional specialties. Wakayama Prefecture, I believe, is one place that makes beautiful umeboshi. But umeboshi is something that every mother or grandmother made at home with their own ume tree. And rather than being a regional thing, I think it's a national tradition. You know, we didn't actually look for regional umeboshi. We just had our own. So it's just like miso, too. Miso, we make our own. That's the traditional Japanese way of life. And yes, you know, certain families make saltier, darker miso as opposed to whiter, sweeter miso. And same with umeboshi.
So does that mean that back in the day, every house had an ume tree in their backyard?
Yes. I think before they started living in high-rise apartments, every family had an ume tree. My upbringing, you know, 60s. In Japan, was very traditional upbringing, and you made your own food. I mean, we're not farmers, but we had farmers that lived nearby, and we didn't buy processed food. Umeboshi was processed at home. But today, if you go to Japan and if you go to Tokyo, I don't think only a handful of people make umeboshi.
I'm thinking that it must have been incredible to walk down the alleys and the streets and see these trees in flower.
Oh, yes. And ume is the first flower, the first tree that flowers in the wintertime. It's the first one and actually stays bloomed for a long time. So my grandmother used to tell me, when you grow up, I want you to be like a ume flower, not a cherry blossom. Because cherries will bloom, they're gorgeous, flamboyant, and they just fall, right? The cherry blossoms fall within a week. But here's this ume that's, you know, has a lot of perseverance, and then it turns into this incredible fruit that makes umeboshi. So she thought that it had more longevity.
More class.
More class and dignity. Oh, she says, I want you to have the dignity like a plum blossom. I said, okay.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much, Sonoko.
Thank you.
It's always such a pleasure to have you share your culture with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Evan. It's always a pleasure to be here.
That was Sonoko Sakai. Sonoko teaches Japanese cooking classes around LA, including her very popular soba workshops. If you want to try your hand at umeboshi, we've got an outtake on the Good Food blog explaining exactly how to do it at home. There's still time to try it with California apricots. Check it out on the Good Food blog. You know that sell-by date on the side of your carton of milk? What do you think that means? We dive into the problematic world of expiration dates next.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. What I want to know is, when did we seed our ability to sniff out rot with our noses to a series of numbers on food packaging? Yes, I'm talking about expiration dates, the apparent culprit of so much massive waste in our food chain. Food scientist Dana Gunders of the National Resources Defense Council says they're not a food dating system. They're a mess. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm okay. So totally curious about the subject, though. So beyond being a mess, how do these food expiration dates lead to greater food waste?
Well, the basic problem is that there is a mass misinterpretation of expiration dates happening across the country. So we have a huge portion of the population, depending on the survey, anywhere from 50 to 90% of Americans who believe that the dates on food are meant to indicate the safety of the food, that after that date they need to throw it out because the food is bad and may make them sick. When in fact, the dates on food are really a manufacturer's suggestion of when the food is at its peak quality, at its freshest, but not something to tell you to throw the food away right then and there.
And this information from the manufacturer, was it meant to be for us, the consumer, or to the retailer?
Well, that really depends on the date. So a lot of people just think the date's the date. But actually, if you look a little closer, there's different wording next to the date. And there are really two buckets of expiration dates, if you will, on a package. One is the sell-by date, and that is really a communication from the manufacturer to the grocery store saying, hey, you should sell the product by this date, and your consumer will be happy when they get it home, and it will still have life at its very best, at its freshest quality. The other bucket is, you know, more consumer-focused dates, and that's your best buy, use by, enjoy by, delicious if used by, and there's actually over 30 different permutations of it. And those dates are really speaking directly to the consumer, saying, if you use the product by this date, the manufacturer, will stand by its quality and, you know, assure you that it will be at its freshest.
Now, are there regulations that cover expiration dates?
Well, actually, the only product where there's a federal regulation around the date is infant formula. And that is because of the nutrient decline, but not because it would make anyone sick. Other than that, there is no federal regulations requiring expiration dates on food. And what's taken its place are state regulations, which do exist, and yet none of them are consistent. So even if you have two states where they both have a law around expiration date for dairy products, they will not necessarily be the same. For instance, New Hampshire requires a date for cream, but not on milk. Montana requires that a product has a sell-by date 12 days after it's been pasteurized, whereas in other states where there's no set date, sometimes products will go 21, even 28 days after pasteurization before the use-by date would indicate anything.
Given that it's such a hodgepodge, why were they brought into being in the first place, and when was that?
Well, around the 70s, as people became more and more distant from their food and grocery stores started carrying more and more products from around the country and even around the world, consumers started wondering how fresh these products were. Around then, we saw a handful of laws actually go to Congress for, you know, national regulation of dates. None of them actually went through, and that's why we have these state laws that have popped up in their place. But really, the whole time, it was out of a concern over freshness. Never was the idea of safety brought into the fold of these dates. And somehow, over the course of the last 40 years or so, people have come to interpret them to be about safety when, in fact, they're not.
So the fact that the supermarket industry is throwing away a lot of food based on expiration dates, do they have to do that, or is it in response to what they think the customer is going to say or think if they see that expiration date still on the shelf?
It's really the latter. Most grocery stores take products off of their shelves 2 to 3 days before the date on the product, and that's regardless of if it's a sell-by date or use-by date or any other kind. And that's because their consumers, they know their consumers don't like to see today's date on a product.
Are there rules for supermarkets about donating expired food?
There are some laws state by state that restrict the sale of product after those dates, but they don't restrict the donation. And so any grocer can donate food as long as they consider it to be still in good condition, even if it's after the date.
So given that we now are looking at this massive food waste problem, which seems to be like one of the big issues that journalists are exploring this year, are there any ideas for coming up with a better labeling system that will lead to less waste?
Well, the first really important step, in my opinion, is to have dates done the same way throughout the country. The dates come across to consumers as this very official system, when in fact it's kind of the Wild West. You have manufacturers just approximating, and they're using all sorts of different ways to come up with their dates. You know, they mean different things when you dig into them. Sometimes a date will actually be developed because the color changes slightly or texture changes slightly. In other cases, it's really a matter of how many complaints they've gotten from consumers, or perhaps they did a consumer taste test, and when 7 out of 8 consumers rated it a 6.9 instead of a 7, that's when the date time frame was set. Then I think we really need to just go out and educate consumers on the fact that these dates are about freshness, and that products can often be eaten days, weeks, even months after the date, depending on the product. And I think the third thing actually has nothing to do with dates. It really has to do with us being more comfortable with our food and how to know when it's okay to eat and when it's not. You know, those dates, they can't really know how you've handled your product. For instance, if you go shopping and then leave the groceries in the car for an hour while you watch your kid's soccer game, you know, the date can't possibly reflect the degradation in the food that's occurred because of that. And so just really taking a little more personal responsibility in knowing how to handle our foods and how to, you know, treat them so that we are increasing our likelihood of eating safe food.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dana Gunders is a food scientist with the National Resources Defense Council. Her book, Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, is now available for pre-order on Amazon. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Thanks to everyone who works on Good Food. That's Jillian, Laryl, Ronnie, and Gary. I'm Evan, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.